Today on Against the Grain, egalitarianism is a thing of our distant past, or so we learn from conventional history. After a long stretch as hunter-gatherers roaming in small bands, our societies became bigger and more complex. And as they became larger and cities emerged, hierarchy was inevitable in the form of kings, priests, and bureaucrats. The late anthropologist and anarchist David Graeber and the archaeologist David Wengrow, however, argue that that's all wrong. In a more hopeful reading of the past, they contend that small-scale societies have often been hierarchical and large-scale ones more egalitarian. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. How we understand our origins as human beings shapes our sense of what's possible in the future. So contend David Wengrow and the late David Graeber, authors of The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. Today we're airing the first of a two-part series on The Dawn of Everything, with David Wengrow, Professor of Comparative Archaeology at University College London. The second part will feature an interview with David Graeber about the book, recorded before his untimely death. David Wengrow, when we grapple with the past, we are almost always making arguments about what the future could possibly hold, which of course is complicated and can obscure the way we read the past. You note that how we tend to see the past is shaped by two thinkers. Jean-Jacques Rousseau argued that humans lived in a state of innocence that then fell apart, whereas Thomas Hobbes, writing a century before Rousseau, argued that human history has been marked by small groups fighting each other in a state of war. You and David Graeber reject both of these visions. Tell us why.
Well, there's an irony here, which is that neither of the writers you're referring to, neither Rousseau nor Hobbes, ever claimed that they were writing history. They both were philosophers, respectively, in the 17th and 18th centuries, who were writing in a genre of They were state of nature theorists, which meant that they allowed themselves to speculate about the original state of humankind without any evidence as such. And Rousseau is particularly explicit about this in his second discourse on the origins of inequality among mankind, published in 1754. He says explicitly, "Do not take what I'm saying here as the facts of history. This is," I forget the exact term to use, but what he's conveying here is that this is a thought experiment, this is a fable, an allegory, a way of thinking about our contemporary predicaments and inequality in particular. So something very strange has happened, whereby over the centuries, these accounts that were never intended as history or social science or anything like that have been put to exactly the opposite purpose from that which was intended. If you look at the recent books of Steven Pinker, for example, he is a self-proclaimed neo-Hobbesian. You know, he will actually say things like, well, Hobbes was basically, strangely, right about the, you know, this original state of our species. If you pick up Yuval Harari or Francis Fukuyama or Jared Diamond, they will say, sometimes more or less explicitly, I am a neo-Rousseauian. You know, Rousseau actually had it right. Now, there's two things about that, I guess. One is that it would be very peculiar if after 2 to 3 centuries of empirical scientific research in the fields of archaeology and anthropology and history and so on, that what we'd ended up with somehow matched the philosophical musings of an Enlightenment philosopher 250 years ago. That would be a hell of a coincidence. But that's essentially what some of these books are claiming. The other thing is that these fables, these allegories, were explicitly rooted in their time. You know, they had a context. Hobbes was writing during the English Civil War, in which he fell victim himself to, I think he was in exile, his home country's in a state of chaos. So he's arguing for the necessity of strong central government. You know, it's not a coincidence. Explicitly oriented towards his contemporary situation. Rousseau is living in what at that time is pre-revolutionary France of the Ancien Régime, one of the most hierarchical and highly ranked societies probably in the whole of human history, where, strangely enough, the question of the day, because he writes his piece as an entry to an essay competition set by the Académie Dijon, where the question of the day, oddly enough, is this all natural? Has it always been this way? Have we always lived in hierarchy? Or was there once something else? And the answer which he gave was so peculiar and ingenious. His state of nature is one in which human beings don't even exist in groups. It's an entirely fantastical idea that, you know, there's this kind of proto-human-like creature that lives in isolation and avoids contact with any other person in order to maintain its happiness and its freedoms, and any kind of social contact or mutual engagement leads inevitably in his story to dependencies which then produce inequalities. So it's a very odd sort of conceit that he comes up with. So it's strange in a way that we're even debating Hobbes and Rousseau these days. And a lot of what we do in the book is to push back using modern evidence from our fields, archaeology and anthropology, to push back against this very extreme kind of selectivity. You know, it's basically egregious cherry picking that allows you to claim that either one of them was correct about the early condition of human societies. Because, you know, in order to go with Hobbes these days, you've got to ignore a huge amount of evidence, and vice versa. In order to go with Rousseau these days, you've basically got to just turn a blind eye to huge bodies of evidence for violence, warfare, interpersonal injuries, going way back as far as the archaeological record takes us into the, you know, the Stone Age, the Paleolithic times.
So, as you pointed out, ideas aren't produced in a vacuum. They take place in the context of the social upheavals and politics of the day. You and David Graeber point to the research that's been done in the last 20, 30, 40 years in the fields of archaeology and anthropology that point to a different kind of early history of humans. And I wonder if you could tell us about that research, but also whether it too faces certain limitations. I mean, obviously, we're talking about reaching into distant times, so reading the evidence. But also, do you feel like these questions of interpretation are also tempered by our times?
Well, as I see it, our job as researchers is to convey the state of knowledge to the best of our knowledge, to the best of our ability. In other words, if evidence exists, deal with it, use it, don't turn a blind eye to it. Yes, the evidence, the further back you go, becomes very, very fragmentary, so that actually, you know, if our species has been around in more or less the form that we are now, biologically, cognitively, probably for at least 200,000 years, maybe longer, for most of that time, we have very little evidence, if any at all, about how people were organizing themselves in social terms. It's really only about 30, 40,000 years into the past that we even begin to get enough evidence to begin to make interpretations of any sort. What we do in the book is precisely that. And that's the difference, is that the kind of evidence we're talking about simply doesn't even feature in some of the other books I've mentioned. They just ignore it. For example, going back to the last ice age in Europe, largely as a result of a century of very intense, well-funded research on the European continent, it's not that there's anything special about Europe, there are these examples of people individuals, hunter-gatherers, buried at various places in the landscape across the continent of Europe, all the way from Eastern Europe over to the Mediterranean. Individuals buried essentially like royalty. Remember, these are supposed to be pre-agricultural societies living in egalitarian bands of 20 or 30 people or something. And instead, what we have are these rich burials, absolutely saturated with personal ornamentation, jewelry, elaborate weapons and regalia. And we have sites like Dolní Vesternice in Moravia, is one of the most famous, which are anything but small hunter-gatherer camps. They're more like a little sort of metropolis or micro-city, with people clearly coming together at certain times of year in very large numbers. The archaeological science these days is very good. You can see people moving about the landscape, procuring, trading resources over very impressive distances. And this evidence is important. You know, it's really not good enough to just turn a blind eye and say, well, until the origins of farming, everybody was basically living in egalitarian societies. And it's not just the kind of stuff I've been talking about. You can look anywhere in the world. Take Japan, for example. Before the coming of rice farming to Japan, you have evidence for something like 10,000 years of very sophisticated, very dynamic hunter-gatherer societies. Sometimes they're building monuments, sometimes they're burying people like kings and queens, sometimes they're living in settlements with great monumental storage facilities. Look at America. In Louisiana, 3,500 years ago, you have the site of what's called now Poverty Point, which was some kind of hunter-gatherer metropolis where literally thousands of people must have been coming together to create these immense earthworks that that you see today. So clearly, something has to change in the way that we talk about how human societies comported themselves before the coming of agriculture. And we spend some time in the book, in the early chapters, trying to bring some of the richness of the contemporary evidence to the reader's attention and exploring some of the implications.
We'll talk in a moment about the Neolithic or agricultural revolution, which is meant to be this crucial turning point in human history. But since you're arguing that 30,000 years ago, 40,000 years ago, in a period of time where we lived in egalitarian, small-scale bands of hunter-gatherers, you're saying that the evidence indicates that's not true.
Well, it may have been true sometimes. I mean, one of the interesting things we found is that many of these groups actually seem to alternate, often on a seasonal basis, between what may be certain times of year, little bands. Sometimes they're hierarchical, sometimes they may be egalitarian. But then these were societies that would often flip their social structures in the most incredible ways that we ourselves would find inconceivable today, moving between societies that may have had strict rules about property, for example, to ones that were essentially communistic. But the same people doing it, stepping in and out of very different kinds of social arrangements, often in concert with seasonal changes in the availability of resources. You know, if you have a fish runs or a nut harvest or herd of bison coming through, people would very flexibly adapt, not just in the sense of biological, physical adaptation, but they would actually change the size and the scale of their societies, and also their legal systems, their moral, ethical, and their political systems. So what we find is not this rather bland idea that you get from social evolution of pre-agricultural societies in egalitarian bands, but something more like, it's very playful. You know, these sort of costume dramas of people trying out forms of inequality or aristocracy, Or putting up great stone temples like the ones at Göbekli Tepe in the Middle East, and then taking them out of commission again, tearing them down. A much more experimental picture of early human social life than the one that we've been accustomed to is what's really come into view.
So then, are there conclusions that can be drawn, given that oscillation you're just talking about the advent of class society, a crucial question in thinking about human history?
Well, one thing you can say about class or ranks is that the first evidence we have for them seems to be precisely in this zone of ritual play. So class seems to be, you know, the idea that you have these human figures who are just qualitatively different. And what's really fascinating about some of the burials, those very early rich burials I mentioned, is that the individuals in question have been very detailed studies of their anatomy and their physical conditions, and some incredibly high percentage, I mean, it cannot be coincidental, I think it's something like 70% of these skeletons have very obvious physical anomalies. Maybe very short, very tall, congenital conditions. And of course, that's just what we see in the physical remains. We don't know about pigmentation, eye color, or about their intellectual characteristics. But it seems that the people singled out in this way were exceptional individuals who would have clearly stood out from their social group. Now, if you want to talk about class or rank, it's very interesting, I think, because, you know, these are people who we today would probably refer to as disabled, people who are disadvantaged, but who in these cases actually seem to have been singled out for some kind of exalted status. And of course, they must have lived to a good old age, you know, quite often have been cared for in order to be buried the way that they were at all. So it's very interesting going back to, you know, these kind of Hobbes versus Rousseau arguments. If you wanted to take on the Hobbes position using information of this kind, you could say, well, no, quite to the contrary of being some savage warlike state, humans were originally these very altruistic, caring, generous kind of people who would support people in their communities. But that would be very naive too, you know, then you're back into the land of Rousseau or something. The truth is that what we see is people, much like us, making choices, sometimes going this way, sometimes going that way. But the key point is that they have a choice to make. And I think the question then becomes not so much what is the origin of inequality, because we can no longer talk unproblematically about a pre-unequal, you know, a society, an original society of equals. Instead, the question becomes, well, if human beings spent most of our time in evolutionary terms switching so flexibly, flipping between forms of egalitarianism and hierarchy, how did we get stuck? How do we lose that freedom? It's a question that I think goes beyond class and beyond rank. It's really a question about the capacity of human societies to alter their own arrangements.
Indeed, and one that we'll return to. I should say I'm speaking with archaeologist David Wengrow. He is the author, with David Graeber, of The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity, which is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So the Neolithic or agricultural revolution is seen as a fundamental turning point in human history, the end of this era, which is a period of the majority of human history, in fact, where we presumably lived in small groups as hunter-gatherers, more or less in an egalitarian way. And that 10,000 years ago, agriculture first developed and upended society fundamentally. Why do you reject this notion of an agricultural revolution, and how do you see the unfolding of the emergence of agriculture?
Well, it's not just us rejecting it. We're drawing on a huge body of research here from right across the world. where, particularly in the last 20 or 30 years, we found out a lot more about what the transition to agriculture looked like in different parts of the world. And the picture really does not resemble what you've just described as the Neolithic or agricultural revolution at all. In fact, I can't really think of a single proficient scholar, prehistorian, who would even use that term anymore in the sense that you're describing it. So the fact that one still has popular science books or so-called big history books repeating this, I'm afraid, you know, that's simply a case of people not keeping up with where the state of knowledge is. And where that state of knowledge is, in brief, is that we now know that there are at least 10, possibly considerably more, independent centers of plant and animal domestication scattered across all the world's continents. And in no single case was there a revolutionary switch from foraging to farming. In fact, what we see everywhere from China to Mesoamerica and the Middle East is a much more gradual process where human beings, who, let's remember, are highly proficient practical botanists, these are people who've been engaging with various forms of wild plant and animal life for many, many generations, begin after the end of the last ice age to play around. They begin to tinker with the idea of cultivation. But very often what happens is that they begin farming and then they move out again. Or they do a little bit of farming. The technical term in the anthropological literature is low-level food production, which basically means you're doing a bit of farming, but you're keeping up your hunting and your gathering and your fishing. So you're not actually getting locked in to a kind of strict agricultural regime where you become like a peasant farmer who spends all of their time toiling in the fields and weeding and getting ready for the next harvest. No, it's not like that at all. In any part of the world, possibly one exception. In fact, what you see is, again, something much more playful and experimental, and sometimes it goes the other way. There's a striking example in my own country, in the British Isles, where the farming economy arrives in Britain from continental Europe about 6,000 years ago. And then around 3000 BC, people stopped doing it, or they stopped doing a crucial part of it. They basically abandon the raising of crops. They hold on to some of the domestic animals, pigs and the cattle, but they actually go back to gathering hazelnuts and other wild resources as their staple plant food. And it's quite fun because this is actually the period when Stonehenge and other famous monumental structures of the Neolithic period go up all over the British Isles, as far north as Scotland. It's actually a phase in which people have retreated or rejected cereal farming in favor of what we would normally consider a more primitive or early form of economy. So the story is often, you know, back to front, in the same way that in the American Southwest, by the time European colonists showed up, most of what had formerly been farming societies, the so-called Pueblo civilization, had actually been abandoned or kicked out and replaced by hunter-gatherers. So there was no one linear path. There was no switch to agriculture in that sense. And what that also means is that it just becomes terribly simplistic to talk about the effects of the adoption of farming. There was no one series of effects. In some cases, like in the Middle East, in fact, where we have one of the earliest transitions to farming, the first societies to adopt farming actually look very egalitarian, including in terms of gender and women's status within these early farming villages. In many ways, they look more egalitarian than the hunter-gatherers who still exist, you know, on their margins in neighboring parts of the world. Same in continental Europe. We have these coastal forager-fisher-hunter societies, which look much more hierarchical in some respects than the early farmers who migrate into that region and become their neighbors. So the story that we're familiar with is much too simplistic. and is really just a sort of hangover from these Enlightenment fables. We are well beyond that now in terms of the state of our knowledge. So what we try and do in the book, in The Dawn of Everything, again, is just bring readers up to speed on a lot of this stuff.
And one of the things that you argue that research indicates is the idea that settlements followed agriculture is actually wrong. Tell us about that and the implications for understanding, say, large egalitarian cities and settlements.
If you look at the actual evidence for the earliest cities in the world, they begin to appear from around 5,000 years ago in various parts of the world, in some cases slightly earlier. And it's always been kind of assumed that human beings moving into very large, densely occupied settlements must have, again, been some kind of threshold. Surely, you know, that's the point where we had to invent central forms of management and administration, if only to keep track of each other and of the sheer volumes of goods and information that go along with living in cities. Surely people have speculated this must have necessitated putting up great leaders and kings in order to keep order and govern such large, complicated societies and just prevent them descending into chaos. Well, no, it turns out this is another quite tenacious myth. If you look directly at the evidence for the earliest cities on various continents, you don't see one pattern. Some of them, more or less, follow what I've just described. They do become quite stratified and hierarchical. But other early cities look completely the other way. And we give various examples in the book, which we can go into if you like. But the key point is that, again, you know, the birth of cities seems to be a much more diverse, much more experimental, consciously experimental process. People trying things out. Some of them begin very hierarchical, and then they switch, and people go off in a different direction and start producing fabulous public housing for most of the citizens instead of building pyramids. This is what seems to have happened in the Valley of Mexico around 250 AD, at the famous ancient city of Teotihuacan. In other cases, like these very early cities north of the Black Sea in what today is Ukraine, they never become hierarchical. You have tens of thousands of people coming together in these vast settlements, which never exhibit evidence for social elites. There are no temples, no palaces, no wealthy burials, actually very few indications of inequality at all. And the latest archaeological work on those settlements suggests that most decision-making was done at the local level, neighborhood councils and local assemblies and that kind of thing. So again, you know, we have to do away with these rather outdated notions of social evolution that you can still find in some of the literature.
Archaeologist David Wengrow is my guest. We'll return with him after this music break. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with David Wengrow. He is Professor of Comparative Archaeology at University College London and the author with the late David Graeber of The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. That's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and you can find a link to it at againstthegrain.org. Today's interview is part one of a two-part series we're going to air about The Dawn of Everything. Part two features an interview that I did with David Graeber about the book before his death last year. So let me ask you, David, about this question, which is one of the central issues that you grapple with in The Dawn of Everything, of the idea that egalitarian societies must be small, and that inevitably, as societies become larger and more complex, they become less egalitarian. States are necessary, kings are necessary, bureaucrats are necessary. So it might be fine to imagine that there was the possibility of living in a more egalitarian way deep in our prehistory, but now that's really off the table. Can you tell us about that argument and what the research to do with early human civilization indicates?
Yes. Well, if there is a pattern, and if it indicates anything, it's actually the other way around. What we found was that in the broad sweep of history, cities or even regional confederacies and coalitions organized on egalitarian lines are surprisingly common. They're certainly not some weird anomaly. But what is anomalous are egalitarian families or households. It's actually at the small scale that we see some of the most striking evidence for really radical forms of structural inequality, slavery, gender equality, domestic servitude, the domination of the old by the young. And the archaeology bears this out, but there are also many more recent examples in the literature. For example, the indigenous societies of the west coast of North America, going over from Alaska down through British Columbia, historically kept slaves. These were demographically fairly small, at least in recent centuries, societies that were organized into households, which were highly stratified. There were ranks. So you had nobles, like aristocrats, and then commoners, who were free people, but also a class of hereditary slaves, so their children would be slaves too. There's a detailed study of this called Aboriginal Slavery on the Northwest Coast by the historian Leland Donald. But directly to the south of those groups, you had other indigenous forager societies, also not farming societies, that went quite the other way. Some of them seem to have come from further north and then rejected slavery. So in those cases, you have really small-scale societies with very hierarchical social arrangements. And to give you an example from deeper history, one of the very interesting patterns that's emerged just in the last 10 years or so is about the Middle East, or the area that historians sometimes call ancient Mesopotamia. So these are the modern countries of basically Iraq and Syria, going up towards the highlands of Turkey, where it now seems that for the first 1,000 years of urban life, from roughly 4,000 BC to 3,000 BC, the cities which exist down in the great river valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates appear to be organized on fairly egalitarian lines. And you have really large, dense populations down there, you know, tens of thousands of people living in cities that don't seem to be very hierarchical. No evidence for monarchy, actually not that much evidence for central government at all. But then you look up into the highlands in exactly the same historical period, effectively the neighbors of these people, and you see these much smaller, often tiny groups, which are already doing it. You know, they've got full-blown royal tombs, often with servants and personal retainers ritually killed, you know, sacrificed to go into the tomb of a lord or a lady. So we actually see monarchy and hierarchy emerging on the fringes of cities in these much smaller groups. And this is a pattern that began to emerge in the course of our research. And it's one of those things that we hoped to explore together in future works. Because it has, if you think about it, it has really big implications, especially at the present time when, you know, we're approaching, 8 billion people on the planet. Most people now these days live in cities or megacities or megalopolis or whatever. So this question of what that implies in terms of constraints, can we change social arrangements? Can we change the way we interact with the environment and extract energy? It's very, very important to understand this issue of scale and what it does imply and what it doesn't imply about the possibilities. And history is giving us a whole new picture of that, which in many ways is a more hopeful, optimistic kind of picture, because it turns out that the mere fact of living in very large, dense groups doesn't really determine the kind of societies one has to have in nearly the same way that people have assumed.
I'd like to ask you about Cahokia, which does not illustrate the dynamic that you've just talked about, but which most people, including people in North America, don't know about. Can you tell us about Cahokia and its fate as far as we know, what it was replaced by?
Well, this is fascinating. This is a place in what today is East St. Louis, in the Mississippi Basin, in a region which I believe is called the American Bottom. Something that sounds a bit strange to the ears of an English person, but apparently that's what it's called. Cahokia is this remarkable site. It's been intensively studied by archaeologists. We don't actually know, I think, what it would originally have been called when it first ballooned into a city around 1000 AD, the year 1000 in the Common Era. It becomes by far and away the largest settlement in the Americas north of Mexico. So it's the first really, really big sort of urban formation in the Mississippi Basin, and it extends its influence over a much larger hinterland. It's a phenomenon. Archaeologists love giving impenetrable names to things, so they call it Mississippianization. Is basically, you know, little bits of Cahokia culture cropping up almost as far north as the Great Lakes region and then down sort of south into Louisiana and areas like that. So it clearly becomes the epicenter of something very important. What is that thing? Well, the archaeology of the site suggests a very hierarchical society. As you say, it clearly doesn't fall into that category of egalitarian cities. You have these great pyramid mounds, you have evidence for ritual killings around aristocratic tombs, and even a kind of intense surveillance. So all the settlements around Cahokia more or less vanish, and the whole population is kind of sucked into this vortex where they would have been highly visible and prone to control by whoever is at the center. This is not a society that to our knowledge, used writing systems, or not in any form that we can interpret. So we're working here purely from the archaeological evidence. And what happens to that place is remarkable. Around the year 1400, the whole thing basically begins to fall to pieces. It's referred to as the Cahokia Collapse. Some people don't like the term collapse, but the upshot of all this is that whole regional system begins to crumble, and the site of Cahokia itself is thoroughly abandoned and turned into what's referred to in the literature as a vacant quarter. David and I used to joke, you know, it's a bit like the Forbidden Zone in Planet of the Apes. Nobody goes there, nobody wants to remember it. And then there's kind of a lacuna in our evidence when it's not entirely clear what's going on. Some of these former subsidiaries of Cahokia seem to become little kingdoms, particularly to the south. You get the Kusa chiefs, who are like little petty monarchs. But then further to the north, the sort of Midwest and the eastern woodlands, people seem to be going quite the opposite direction of really rejecting hierarchy and forming these little polis-sized republics, which are actually governed on highly egalitarian principles. And it's these kinds of societies which eventually French, Danish, and English colonists would come into contact with in the more northerly parts of North America, and assumed that they'd always been like that, that they were these kind of innocent children of nature who'd always lived in free and equal societies. Well, no, we're at an interesting point now where we can actually begin to go deeper into the history of these societies and begin to understand that their egalitarianism, far from being some kind of, you know, natural reflex or something, was actually the result of a centuries-long very complex process of rejecting something much more hierarchical in their own histories. And there are even little snippets of oral histories. There are Cherokee traditions about a group called the Anukatani, I think, who were these priest kings who once used to bully everybody and push everyone around. And the story explains how they were got rid of in a rather violent fashion. We're never going back there. There are still many, many pieces of this puzzle missing. But there are enough bits falling into place that one can begin to see something much more like a self-conscious rejection of hierarchy in the centuries in certain parts of the Americas. There are exceptions like the Natchez, again to the south in Louisiana, who were incredibly hierarchical. They actually had a divine king. But there are many other societies that go in completely the opposite direction and were doing so still at the time of European contact.
Archaeologist David Wengro is my guest, author with the late David Graeber of The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, I wanted to ask you about this idea of how societies go from less egalitarian to more egalitarian, because you were describing in early human history something that might even be seasonal. What you're describing now with the end of Cahokia and the rise of these more egalitarian societies is something much less of an oscillation. Do we have enough information about how, I mean, you've described it as almost play, but the kind of agency that has taken place, because it's not like it's really easy for someone to say, hey, let's be egalitarian now, or let's switch to being hierarchical now. I mean, obviously other people have to be on board with you.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess the basic point to bear in mind is the classic Marxian point that, you know, people make choices, but not always under conditions of their own choosing. And I don't think we should confuse the idea that people are free to make choices with the notion that they're necessarily conscious of that freedom. I think, you know, it's clear that many, many people in many points in history have felt stuck in their situations and unable to get out of really horrendous forms of domination and persecution. And I think this is the prevailing atmosphere at the moment. You know, I think part of the reason that some of these other big history books, you know, they really tap into this zeitgeist of people just feeling kind of stuck. And that the cultural system we've got, although we know it's leading us environmentally, if not socially, in a very dangerous direction, is kind of the best we can manage. I mean, there aren't really any alternatives, seems to be the prevailing mood. So addressing this question, you know, how did we get stuck in a situation where we find it so difficult even to imagine other possibilities, let alone put them into effect? This kind of emerges in our book. Once you've done away, you know, once you've done the brush clearing, you cleared away the cobwebs of all these entrenched ideas about, oh, it was agriculture that plunged us into inequality, and then you get property from that, and so on, you know. Or, oh, it was cities, and, you know, once you've done away with all that, you're actually left with something very interesting, kind of a new set of questions about what really makes certain forms of inequality stick. And in the book, we begin to point towards what seem to us suggestive patterns, the beginnings of answers. We're not dogmatic on these points, and we fully acknowledge that they need to be exemplified and researched in much more depth. But we point to various things. For example, violence and warfare in human history, contrary to the assumptions of the neo-Hobbes faction, is not a constant of human history. Actually, what the evidence shows is that warfare comes in and it goes out, and there are phases of peace which are, in prehistory, I mean, which are just as long as the phases of war. There's no overall pattern. What's interesting, though, is why sometimes violence becomes structural. And what I mean by that is that you don't simply have a conflict and people are traumatized and so on, but the trauma becomes part of the fabric of society. And another pattern that began to emerge is about why this seems to happen in certain cases. It seems to be and this may sound a bit abstract, I mean, I can give examples, seems to be when violence, systems of systemic violence, becomes confused or mixed up with its opposite. In other words, cultural systems that are actually about the opposite, they're about tenderness and love and care. You think of ancient Egypt, you know, it's a civilization where, on the one hand, it's extremely violent. You know, they had great empires, there was slavery, peasants had a fairly miserable existence. But on the other hand, much of that civilization was oriented around the idea of caring for the king. That's what all these famous pyramids and pyramid tombs and temples are really about, is everybody at a certain time of year becomes a sort of caretaker for the king, participating in these projects. In the same way that, you know, you may feel a great love and affection for your country, but it's also your country that may demand the ultimate sacrifice. So there's something we found about this nexus between systems of violence and systems of care, which seems very important and is something that we wanted to look into further. We give some pointers in the conclusion of the book about how this really works in practice to break down some of those basic human freedoms.
Well, tell us more about that then, in terms of having some way of navigating through this, because although you're pointing to the enormous complexity of societies throughout history, the enormous variation, is it fair to say that that kind of feeling of being stuck in inequality has become a universal condition across the world? And if so, what can be done about that?
Well, David was very interested and actively involved with groups which are trying very hard to get unstuck in various ways and experiment again with forms of freedom, women's freedoms, and so on and so forth. I think our contribution to this in the book is really to begin to question, you know, what is the relationship between the stories we tell, the meta-narrative, if you like, of our species. What is the relationship between those big stories and the little acts of violence and inequality that plague our societies? What is the relationship there? And what happens if you actually do away with some of these outdated stories, start telling different ones? One of the nicest comments I read in a review, going back to your earlier question, it finished with the point that, you know, imagine a society that adopted all of this modern evidence and the kind of accounts that we're beginning to be able to give. Imagine a society that adopted that as its official origin story. You know, that's what kids learn at school. That's what goes on the curriculum, is that actually this is human history, is this. We're a much more playful, experimental species. And the reviewer made the point that a society which did that would have to be a radically different kind of society. Society from the one that we're living in. So, you know, one can approach this problem of feeling paralyzed in many ways. I think David Graeber was exceptional in so far as he was actively approaching it on many different fronts. I think the book, you know, its contribution is really to make the point that whatever the other obstacles that exist to change, whether it's gender equality or just everyday racism or state violence, crony capitalism, aside from all those other things, history is not against you. You know, there are no social evolutionary forces underpinning these things. Actually, history is your friend. It's on your side.
Well, let me end by asking you about that and what this notion of our history says or illuminates about our possibilities in the present. On the one hand, it may seem more optimistic in the sense that it reminds us that egalitarian societies have been a big part of our past, including, as you argue, societies that were relatively large and complex. On the other hand, it takes away the idea, which admittedly probably few people hold now, that the majority of our history was egalitarian and therefore that is our future, you know, inevitably.
Yes, I mean, that's a fair characterization of what we say. I think what I would emphasize is that You know, if there was anything in Rousseau's fable which we would want to hold on to, it's perhaps this notion that there is something that we lost, but it's not what he thought it was. It's not equality. It really seems to be what we've lost is precisely this ability to remake, redesign our societies in different forms. It's what we call in the book the third basic form of freedom. We identify, again, not dogmatically, we don't claim to have exhausted all the possibilities, but we pinpoint three basic forms of freedom, which seem to have been common to a large number of human societies. There's the freedom to move away from one's immediate surroundings and be received in another place, the freedom to disobey arbitrary commands and be listened to and debated, not simply ostracized or thrown out of one's society, and built on those two other freedoms, the freedom to actually reimagine and redesign societies in different forms. And I think looking to the future, I think that's personally what I'd like to focus on, is maybe just a clearer, more detailed investigation of this question of how those freedoms have been lost, and what are the avenues, you know, what needs to happen in order to reclaim them.
David Wengrow, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with archaeologist David Wengrow. He teaches at University College London and is co-author with the late David Graeber of The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. David Wengrow is also the author of What Makes Civilization and the book The Origins of Monsters. I should say this is part one of a two-part series we're going to air about The Dawn of Everything, part two featuring an interview that I did with David Graeber about the book. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.